for the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men.
As we engaged in singing those songs and recalled in our hymns the facts of the gospel and were singing them together, it thrilled my heart to think of this great number of people uniting their voices together in their hearts and bearing testimony and bearing witness to the truthfulness of these great truths and these great facts that have so tremendously influenced and shaped our lives. Do you realize that we're what we are today because of Jesus Christ? There's not a good thing in any one of you. I know from, if it's me, I know there's not a good thing in me that I can hold up and say, this is mine and I've gained this myself. It's all the Lord Jesus Christ, and it's what he's made us to be. And I thank God for him and for you and for this great period of worship tonight. It's a bit unusual that two series should meet on the same Sunday on such similar ground as the two series we've been in for the last few weeks on Sunday morning and Sunday night. They've met, strangely enough, on the same Sunday, and there's a similarity between the lessons this morning and the lesson tonight. But that will explain, and perhaps that'll be sufficient to explain the similarity between the two. It wasn't planned, it just happened, and it may be that it's to our advantage. There was once a boss on a construction job, and he was approached by a young college student, a boy, wanting a job. And this man said, all right, young man, you see that pile of dirt out there? Take it and move it over to here. So the boy went out and got his shovel and wheelbarrow and worked all morning moving that pile of dirt. He came and reported to the boss and said, sir, it's finished. I've moved it. And the boss said, all right, now take it and move it back where it was. Without a word, without a question, the young man got the shovel and the wheelbarrow and went out and worked the rest of the day moving that pile of dirt back where it was. He came and reported to the boss and said, it's done. The man said, the job is yours. You may say, well, that's kind of foolish, isn't it? But not really. On second thought, as you look at it the second time, you'll see that there's a great bit of wisdom in that simple interview. It took a very small bit of time as far as the conversing between the two men. And when it was finished, there was something very real that had been determined. And there's a lot of wisdom in it. We're going to notice what that wisdom was in just a few moments. But first, I want us to notice once again another characteristic of God. We've noticed in our study in Isaiah the wisdom of God. We've noticed his majesty. We've noticed his omniscience, his omnipresence, his omnipotence. We've noticed his grace. We've noticed his love. We've noticed his condescension to the needs of man. We've noticed all of these qualities. Tonight I want to notice with you yet one more quality of the Lord, and that is the foolishness of God. The foolishness of God. This is an expression that occurs, as far as I can determine, only one time in all the Bible. And that's here in this first chapter of 1 Corinthians, the 25th verse, where the apostle says that the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and that the weakness of God is stronger than men. And tonight, I want to just simply ask you a question. Is there a foolish streak in God? You know, it doesn't take long after being with someone till you can begin to see in their personality certain traits that, their eyes may twinkle at something, the mention of something you know. Or it may be that the suggestion that we do something in a certain way gets an immediate response from them. And you see, you know, there's a little foolishness in them. Or there's a certain turn of their personality that kind of makes you chuckle. I think there's something like that in God's personality. I really believe that there's a funny bone kind of in God. There's a little funny characteristic about him that he describes here, that Paul describes here, as the foolishness of God. Now, there are a lot of things that we do that are foolish that this does not refer to. There are a lot of men who are men of great stature. The President of the United States perhaps recently has done some things that are foolish. And we might refer to that as the foolishness of the President, or the foolishness of some senator, or something that someone has done on the spur of the moment that has put them out on a limb, and then they realize that they're in a position that's very embarrassing, and that could be referred to as foolishness. But that's not what Paul is talking about, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a certain quality of God that is referred to here as foolishness that could be looked upon as a characteristic of his personality that simply causes him to do something in a certain way in his relationship with people, with human beings. And I think it's worth looking at. In every age, we see this strain of the foolishness of God stretching all the way through the Old Testament into the New Testament, and we realize once again that the same God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament. In the times that preceded the coming of Jesus Christ, we see this strain of the foolishness of God. I want to give you two or three illustrations, and then an illustration or so in the New Testament, and then draw a conclusion about it. Two or three of these illustrations in the Old Testament. One of them is the example of his relationship with Abraham. When God had become acquainted with Abraham and had chosen him to leave Ur of the Chaldees and to come on over into the land of Canaan, he told him one day, in the 17th chapter of Genesis it's recorded, he said, "Abraham, I want you to start calling your wife not Sarai, but Sarah, because I'm going to bless her, she's going to bear a son, and I'm going to make her the mother of many nations, and kings of peoples will come out of her. And she's going to bear a son, and you're going to call his name Isaac." Well, this was such a startling announcement to Abraham that he says he fell on his face and laughed. It just tickled him good. And he said, "Shall a woman who is 90 years old have a child?" And he said, "Ishmael might live before you." But God said, "No, Abraham, I want this boy to be named Isaac, and I want him to come from Sarah. And this is the one with whom I will make my eternal covenant, and it'll be a covenant with him from generation to generation in his descendants after him." And so he made this very strong promise to Abraham. Abraham offered him an alternative, and God said, "No, I'm not interested in this alternative. I want to do this way, and I'm going to have you, a 99-year-old man, and this 90-year-old woman, I'm going to have you become the proud parents of a bouncing baby boy." Well, Abraham just fell on his face and laughed. I don't know whether he was rolling on the ground. It was that funny, I guess. But anyway, later on, Sarah heard about it. She heard the three messengers from God overheard them talking with Abraham, and she heard this promise made again when they were out there in Mamre underneath the oak tree and near where the tent was pitched. And Sarah was behind the flap listening, and she heard them make this promise to Abraham, and she got tickled, and she laughed. Later on, Abraham reproached her, you know, and pointed an accusing finger at her. And she said, "Oh, I didn't laugh." "Oh," he said, "but you did." But he didn't tell her that he had also fallen on his face and just laughed out loud, you know, But nevertheless, we find this outstanding arrangement being made between Abraham, between God and Abraham, about the birth of this child. Well, that's all right, and we can adjust to that. Abraham adjusted to it. And sure enough, about a year later, Sarah gave birth to this boy, Isaac. He was accepted into the family. He was circumcised according to the command of God. And he grew up, and I guess about 10 or 12 years later, God did something that was very foolish, really. In fact, it's awfully difficult to understand just why he did it on the surface of the matter. He told Abraham in chapter 22 of Genesis, he said, "Abraham, I want you to take this boy, Isaac, whom you love, your only son, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering upon one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." Well, that's a strange thing, telling him to go and take this only son of his, the son concerning whom he had made the promise and through whom he was going to bring about the coming generations and through whom he was going to cause Abraham and Sarah to become the mother and father of many nations. And now he was telling this man to take this very son that he had made such a fuss over and take him out and offering him as a burnt offering before God. Can you understand that? I don't know. Abraham might have said, had he been obnoxious or had he been maybe out of sorts that day, "But Lord, that's murder, and I'm not going to do it. It's just not right, and I'm not going to stoop to do it, and I'm just not going to carry it out. But he didn't. It says that he got up early the next morning and took the child, took the servant, took some wood, took the fire, and they went for 3 days' journey toward Mount Moriah, and on the third day, it says they saw the mountain. And they came to the base of it, and Abraham told the two men, "You stay here now, and the boy and I are going to go up and worship, and we'll return to you later." And so he did. On the way up the mountain, the young lad began to get the picture. He said, "Father," he said, "Yes, son," he said, "here's the wood and here's the fire, but where's the lamb?" And Abraham said, "God will provide. He'll provide a lamb for the offering." But when he got up on the mountain, having built the altar, having laid the wood and set the fire, he then took this boy and laid him upon that altar and took his knife, ready to drive it through his heart. And God stopped him, said, "That's enough. Don't you touch him. Don't lay a hand on him. Now I know that you fear me." Well, that's strange. It's almost to the point of foolishness, isn't it? And yet God chose to do it. I wonder why he didn't say, "Abraham," way on back there several days earlier, "Abraham, if you fear me, I want you to raise your hand." I wonder why he didn't do that. Or, "Abraham, if you fear me, put your hand on the radio so I'll know, you know, that you really fear me." And yet that's being done today, you know. People want to give some kind of approval or give some indication that they love the Lord or that they want to be saved. And if you want to be saved, raise your hand. But God didn't choose to do it like that. He chose this kind of a foolish thing. He chose maybe to have Abraham move the dirt twice. And so it was that God dealt with Abraham. But there's another example, and that is the Israelites when they were in Egypt. Whenever God was about to deliver the Israelites, he'd already prepared Moses now. They'd been down there for some 450 years, not always that time in slavery, but they'd been in Egypt about that long. And he had promised Abraham now, "I'm going to have them stay in this land for a certain length of time, and then I'm going to call them out of it." And he had prepared Moses for this very thing. And so when Moses came with all of his signs and the power that God had given him, and you might think, "My, my, with all the power that we've got, God's just going to bowl these Egyptians over and we're going to go out." And yet when God came to the final plague and came to the final trump that he was going to play, look at this very foolish thing that he did, really. He said to Moses, "Tell the children of Israel, each family, take a lamb and kill it and save the blood out. And take the lamb," and then he gave instructions about roasting the lamb and eating the lamb. And there's some incidentals about the arrangements to be made. But the thing that was very, more or less foolish, was the fact that he said, "Tell them to take some hyssop," that was a plant, "and dip it in that blood, and sprinkle it upon the door lintel across the top, and then down the sides, the posts of that door." He said, that way, when God visits the land of Egypt tonight, he's coming, when he sees the blood, he'll pass over those houses that have the blood sprinkled upon them, and he won't take the or he won't kill the firstborn in those families where the blood has been sprinkled. Well, that's all right, I guess. And I'm not questioning God's wisdom in it at all, but I'm just wondering what in the world the people who were the Jews must have thought. Didn't he know what houses they lived in? Well, we know that he did, because in three of the plagues, the plague of the boils, that of the hail, and that of the darkness, We know he had already made a distinction between the houses of the Egyptians and the houses of the Israelites. Whenever the Egyptians were in abject darkness and blackness for those days, there was light in the Israelites' house. And the boils didn't affect the Israelites as they affected the Egyptians. And they didn't have the hail over here like they had over here among the Egyptians. So God knew where these people were. Well, why was it then that he asked them to do this silly thing? And somebody could have said, what possible connection could there be between sprinkling blood on a doorpost and my getting out of this place of bondage? What is the point? It just doesn't make sense. It's kind of silly, isn't it? And I guess there may have been Israelites who didn't leave. I suspect that there were some of them that were that hardened that said, no, if that's going to be the way it is, I just won't go. That's the silliest thing I ever heard. I don't think you know what you're talking about anyway. The majority of it says that, in fact, it just simply says the Israelites bowed their head and worshipped, and they did like God had commanded. But it was a bit foolish, wasn't it? But then there's a third example that let me give you, and the reason why I give this is because this man was a Gentile. He was one of our ancestors, you might say. He was one of those who were not really associated with God enough to really know what God expected of them. And we find him a man of high rank in the Syrian army. And they had made some excursions into the land of Israel and had captured some of these people, much like going on over there today. And they had taken prisoners of some of these people and had taken them home. And this little girl had been captured by one of the Syrian soldiers, and she had been taken to the house of this man Naaman. And she had come to live there, and she was a servant of the wife of Naaman. And so one day, having learned that Naaman had leprosy, she said, you know, I wish my Lord were in Samaria with the prophet there, because he could heal him. Well, this message was taken to Naaman, and then Naaman took it to the king of Syria, and the king of Syria was very interested in him, so he sent a note to the king of Samaria and sent gifts and presents and everything, and sent Naaman down there to the king of Samaria and presented him with this note, heal my servant. And the king of Samaria thought, oh me, he's going to pick a fight. He's trying to go to war with me. And look, and he got all upset, and Elisha heard about it, the prophet, and he said, well, now just hold on, send him down to me and I'll take care of it. So he did, and when Naaman came to the house of Elisha, Elisha was inside doing something, so much so that he didn't even take time to go out to Naaman, and I think that was planned. He could have gone out there, you know, and blown trumpets and said, all the people come and watch this great man, but he didn't. He just sent Gehazi out and said, go tell him to dip 7 times in the Jordan and he'll be clean. Ooh, that was just like waving a red flag to a bull to this man. It just absolutely infuriated him. He said, well, I thought surely he would have come out and called upon the name of his God and waved his hand over the place, you know, the leprous spot, and called upon the name of his God, and the leprosy would have been cleansed. He said, I just thought surely that was the way he was going to do it. And he had envisioned this mighty magic spell, you know, or something that he had been accustomed to, all the hubbub and the fal-de-ral that these men were accustomed to going through in their own, in his own country as they tried to bring about these incantations and all. And he thought the same thing would have happened here. But he was dealing with a different kind of a God. He was dealing with a God that had a foolish streak in him, a funny streak in him. And this is what he said, just go tell him to dip in the Jordan 7 times, he'll be clean. No hubbub, no all this process and all and the procedure, none of that. He just said, go tell him to wash 7 times, he'll be clean. Well, it didn't set too well with this man. It says he stomped off in a rage. It just literally says in the 2 Kings, in chapter 5, it made this statement when he was in verse 12. He said, are not Abner and Pharpar and the rivers of Damascus better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? And it says, so he turned and went away in a rage. And that literally means what it says. He had simply had it. He was fed up, all this foolishness. He just couldn't stand it anymore. And he took off in a rage. He wasn't going to do that. Well, his servants were smarter than he was. And they came to him, and you can almost see them gathering about, not quite knowing how to say this, but they said, Master, if he had asked you to do some great thing, you would have done it, wouldn't you? Then why not rather than just go on and wash and be clean like he says? And you know, you can almost see this man's mind beginning to change gears. Here he was in just simply total rebellion against this idea, and then they came and appealed to him and said, look, it's foolish to act like you're acting. Why don't you just go ahead and wash and be clean? And you can just almost hear him grind to a halt, And then start back in the other direction and say, right, you're right, I'm going to do that. And the transformation that took place inside this man was no less pronounced than the transformation that took place outside him when he dipped in the water seven times. And so he humbled himself and went on and dipped four, five, six times. Nothing happened. On the seventh time, he dipped, and sure enough, he came up and he says his skin was like a baby's skin. And then he went to the house of Elisha and he said, now I know that there's no God anywhere except in Israel. And he made some of the most beautiful statements about his intentions to worship God. He asked for consideration from this God as he said, I'm going to have to go with my Lord, the king, into the house of Rimmon, and I'm going to have to stand there with him while he worships this stump. And he said, will you please excuse me while I have to stand there and help him? And he made some of the most beautiful statements. But anyway, the point I'm making is this, that God chose to deal with this man in this particular way and say, now this is what I want you to do if you want to be healed. But the point, it keeps coming back to us, why? And what's the purpose of it? And you might say, well, that was all before the coming of Christ. We're living in a different age now, and we're living in a time when people are more, you might say, sophisticated, or at least they're more developed, and we don't... Surely God doesn't deal with us like that anymore. He dealt with them back there, and that was the way you know he was then, but he doesn't do like that anymore, does he? No, you're wrong. He does. He's the same God then as he is today. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And the same funny streak or the foolish streak in him back then we see manifest in him today also. For example, when we come to the New Testament age, we see him having his Christ child born in a manger, not in a palace. We see him consigning him and putting him over in Nazareth of Galilee in a despised city there. We have him surrounded by people who were no account really as far as society is concerned. We see him, in Isaiah's words, growing up like a root out of dry ground. And as a man from whom men hide their face, he was despised. We see him then being called upon by this God to die upon a cross as a common thief among common thieves, and he was reckoned as one of the transgressors. We see him then appealing to people and simply saying to them, I want you to believe on this man. He's my son, and I want you to accept him as the Son of the living God. We see him requiring him to die, as I say, on the cross. We see him then requiring those people who would be followers of his to go through this foolish act of being immersed in water, this thing of a mock burial where we as human beings, as grown people, individuals, grown men and women being required to go into a mock death where we come up looking like a drenched rat and we go on and that before people. What is the point? And what is all this making us move the dirt twice? Is there something that he's trying to tell us and something that he's trying to accomplish? Well, the thing that it accomplished among some people was just simply this. They said it's absolute foolishness. To the Jews, it was a stumbling block, this thought about the Christ. He says there that the word of the cross is foolishness to those that are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. And then it goes on and talks about how that the Jews ask for signs and the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. But what's the explanation for it? Why is this foolish streak in God? And what is there about us that it requires him to so condescend to let us see this foolish side of it? What is there about us? Well, it's just simply this. The foolishness of God calls upon men to humble themselves to the point that they say, I want God to be my Lord. And I'm going to do what he says, even though it's foolish, even though it makes no sense to me. Even though I can see no earthly connection between what he's asking and what he's trying to accomplish, I'm going to do what he says. I'm willing for God to be the ruler of my life. And the foolishness of God drives us to that extremity in our life to where we say, you know, I can't see any sense in it. It doesn't make sense to me. But if he wants me to do it, that's what I'm going to do. You know, man's basic problem is his pride and his willingness or his desire to be free of responsibility to God. We want to be independent of God. That was Eve's basic problem. When Satan said, you can be a God yourself, that's really what she wanted. She didn't want to have to depend upon God. She didn't want to have to surrender to him. She wanted to be her own boss. And we're all like that. All of your relationships with your wife, with your husband, with your boyfriend, with your girlfriend, If you have any problems in those relationships, you know what it stems from? It stems from pride. It stems from your own feeling that your own needs have a precedence and take precedence over the needs of anybody else. And it stems from your desire to be independent of God and independent of the needs of other people. If you could ever settle those issues, then you'd have everything really settled in your relationship both with men and with God. When it came to Abraham, what God was actually asking Abraham was this: Abraham, do you trust me? Or he could have said, Abraham, if you trust me, raise your hand. I don't doubt what Abraham would have raised his hand, but God wouldn't have known any more than he knew before. But I want you to see this. I don't think it was what God was trying to find out for himself as what he was trying to get Abraham to find out about Abraham. And when he said to the Jewish people, I want you to sprinkle this blood on the doorpost, it may not have been so much wanting to find out where the Jews were as wanting the Jews to find out where they were. Whose side are you on? Are you on my side or are you on the Egyptian side? And when he came to Naaman, or Naaman came to God and says, I want to be healed, I don't think it was so much wanting God to find out whether Naaman feared God or not as to find out whether Naaman, or for Naaman to find out whether Naaman feared God and believed. There was the crux of the matter. And so it's the crux of the matter with you and me today. Pride is still our problem. Our desire to be independent of God is still our problem. And consequently, God has done something in order to test us. He's asked us to move the dirt twice. He's done something that's foolish so that we would say, well, you know, that is kind of foolish, but I'm going to do it anyway. And you know, God could have fixed it this way. It would have curled your brain. He could have cooked every cell in your head. He could have devised a plan that was so wonderful, and Paul even talked about it. He said, when I came to you, I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God in lofty words of wisdom. Paul could have done it too. Paul could have used such words that absolutely they'd have had to have had a dictionary to follow him, you know, and they'd have gone away saying, that's the smartest man I ever heard. Or God could have done it in such a way where only about 5% of the whole human race would have ever understood what he was talking about. He could have fixed it in such a way, and he could have couched it in such terms, and could have used such such technical language and all of that, so that only a very few elite people would have been able to go away and say, they say, did you understand what he said? Yeah, I got that. Didn't you get it, you ignoramus? And you know what you'd have had? You'd have had the church made up of a bunch of people who were so completely conceited and self-contained that they had no need of anybody else and no need of God. They were all bigots, and there they were, feeling like they had accomplished it themselves. But God's smarter than that. He fixed it to so only those people who are just like He wants them, only those people get into the kingdom of God. And He did it through this thing of foolishness. That's why it says in 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, that God did something. God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what's weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. He's the source of your life in Christ Jesus, whom God made our wisdom, our righteousness, our sanctification, and our redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let him who boasts, boast of the Lord. You don't have anything. You don't deserve anything. You can't accomplish anything. But what God can do through you is absolutely astounding and amazing. But gloat in the Lord, and boast in the Lord, and glory in the Lord. And God chose to use His foolishness to accomplish that. A dead Jew on a cross? What possible connection could that have between me and my best interest or my salvation? What good was a dead Jew on a cross? And this thing about being baptized into the death of a man and going through a foolish ceremony like that, what's the point? I don't understand it. And what is all this rigmarole you're talking about blood? What's blood got to do with it? What is all this? And a lot of people just literally are offended by it. And one of the denominations in America some 10 years ago made a ruling in one of their joint sessions at their conclave, and they ruled out the name or the word blood out of every song that is in their hymnal. No reference to blood is to be found in that denomination's hymnal today because it's offensive to them. And they weren't able or willing to say, yes, Lord, I'll let you determine what's to be the means of my salvation, and I'll just gladly accept it. Whatever you say, I'll go along with, and I'm thankful for that privilege. Some people reject the cross of Christ because it's simply sheer foolishness. To the Jews, it's a stumbling block. The same people that accepted or that rejected the cross of Jesus Christ then reject the same reference to death today in a person's conversion. They cannot stomach the idea that a person has to be immersed in water for the forgiveness of his sin. They just cannot see it. It's a stumbling block to them. Those who are Gentiles and who are so elite, you know, and who are so educated, they say, I just can't understand it. It has nothing whatsoever to do, and so I'm not going to have anything to do with it. Well, that's your choice. You don't have to move the dirt twice if you don't want to. But God is using it for a purpose. Do you want the job or not? You're applying for salvation? All right. Take this load of dirt and move it over here. And when you've gotten through, then move it back where it was before. Are you willing to move the dirt twice for the Lord? That's what he's asking you. And that's what his foolishness does. The foolishness of God serves kind of like a strainer, a paint strainer. Did you ever take your wife's good hose and pour paint down through it and watch what happens? Take the foot, really, is where it really works best. Pour it down through that foot. If you don't have a paint strainer, it's a wonderful thing. Man, just get a hose, part of a hose, and pour it down through there and watch what happens. It strains out all that paint that's already hardened. It strains out all the paint that's no longer pliable. It no longer yields to the paint brush in the master's hand. It's already set up. It's already become hardened. It's no longer useful to the painter. God's foolishness in the scriptures, and you can find it in every dispensation from the very first with Adam and Eve on down through the present day dispensation through Christ. You can find these little points of foolishness all the way through God's revelation and his association with man. And that foolishness serves as that woman's hose or that paint strainer that strains out the paint that's already hardened and lets the pliable paint on through to where it can be used and made fit for the master's use. God's foolishness provides us with that strainer by which he strains out that's no longer usable to him, that is no longer pliable. It strains out those people who've already become so set in their ways that they're not going to do anything but what they want to do. And God, just simply having strained them out, just throws them aside and reserves them to be burned. And God's foolishness serves that purpose in our lives today. That's why he said, blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's why he said to his disciples, whoever becomes humble like one of these little children, or whoever humbles himself like this little child, he's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. That's why Peter said, humble yourselves therefore under the mighty hand of God. He'll exalt you in due season. That's why Peter also said, sanctify in your hearts, or settle your mind, this one thing, that Jesus Christ is going to be the Lord of your life. That's what he's talking about. Are you willing to make him the Lord of your life? The foolishness of God is wiser than men. And this streak in God that says, I'm going to condescend to tell you something that may sound foolish to you, but I know what I'm doing. I want you to move this dirt twice. I want you, if you will, to be my disciple or to be my child. I want you to come in faith. I want you to repent of your sins, turn your back upon them. And you know, that sounds reasonable. And people have told me that makes sense. But this thing about going through this baptism doesn't make a bit of sense to me, and I'm not going to do it. I've had them tell me that. But that's the purpose that's why he put it here. He put it here so he could strain out those of you who are just so set in your ways that you're not going to do it. And it'll serve its purpose, just as the cross did in the first century, just as the cross does today, and just as this counterpart or this thing that associates with the cross, it'll strain you out today if you're not going to be pliable and surrender yourself to God for his use. Isn't that strange? And it's simple, and it's beautiful, and you can see it all the way through the Bible, the way you just stand and you kind of laugh at it, and you see that twinkle in God's eye as he decides, I'm going to test you now to see whether or not you're willing to be my disciple and let me be God. Well, if you want to become a Christian tonight on this basis, that God is God, you're going to let him be boss. He's already described the way, and it's very simple. The only thing that determines whether or not you'll go with it or not is whether or not you're willing to surrender to him. If you are, come. If you're not, we are sorry. We pray for you. Perhaps you will some other time. But if you want to obey him tonight, come in his way, and he'll save you while we stand and sing.